Welcome to the Maine Historical Society podcast. These podcasts explore the experiences of Maine people in a changing world and the connections between local, state, and national history. To learn more about our programs, please visit us online at www.mainehistory.org/programs.
Hello, welcome to another virtual program with Maine Historical Society. I'm Kathleen Newman. It's June 21st, 2022, and this is our book talk, Only the Clothes on Her Back, Clothing and the Hidden History of Power in the 19th Century United States with Laura F. Edwards. And this program is a part of our series on Northern Threads, the companion series to our exhibit of the same name. And you can learn more about that exhibit, the program series, buy tickets to see the exhibit if you visit our website, mainehistory.org. So the author of four books, Laura Edwards, is a legal historian whose research focuses on the 19th century United States. She holds a bachelor's in American culture from Northwestern University and a PhD in history from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She taught at Duke University and is currently a professor at Princeton, where she teaches courses in the history of law in the United States at both the undergraduate and graduate levels. Dr. Edwards, thank you so much for being here with us this evening.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's so nice to be here. Thank you for the invitation. So I want to start tonight with six women and a sheet. And all of them, the women and the sheet, appeared in the New York City Mayor's Court in 1804. But actually, it was the sheet that started it all. One of the women, Sarah Allingham, charged another woman, Judith Friel, with stealing the sheet, although the charges vastly oversimplified that situation. So Judith Friel was a washerwoman who just happened to have the sheet among the dirty laundry that she was collecting that day. So imagine her consternation where Sarah Allingham waylaid her in the street, grabbed up her bundles, and began rummaging through them. So when Sarah Allingham found what she insisted was her sheet, how she could identify the sheet amongst all the dirty laundry remained unexplained, but nonetheless, she said it was her sheet. She announced her discovery to everyone on the street and marched off with the sheet to file charges, and Friel was sort of following in her wake at that point. So once in the mayor's court, it became clear that Friel was in fact merely transporting the sheet. It was another woman, Sally Riley, who had taken it nearly a year earlier. Riley had then sold it to yet another woman, Rosanna Marara, whose bundle of laundry was the one that contained the sheet. So both of those women joined the other two. So now we have four women and a sheet in the New York City Mayor's Court. Then two more women appeared as witnesses to support Rosanna Marara's claims that she had purchased the sheet from Sally Riley, bringing us all told to six women and a sheet. So after listening to the evidence, the court awarded the sheet to Rosanna Marara. She had evidence to prove ownership in the form of witnesses who could describe it. It was a homespun sheet sewn down the middle. They could provide the date of purchase. It was the previous winter because there was snow on the ground. And they could also provide the purchase price, which was 6 shillings. Sarah Allingham had only outrage and drama, which were in fact very impressive, but in this case, not dispositive. So case closed, or so it would seem. But in fact, not really, because the verdict raises more questions than it resolves. First, the time and effort devoted to this one sheet seem way out of proportion to its value. Yet it was clearly memorable and meaningful to all of those involved. Even court officials, all white men who dutifully heard out all the evidence, never questioned the item's importance. So all the attention lavished on this one sheet then raises another question. Why did these women and this sheet appear in the New York City Mayor's Court at all? Sarah Allingham and Rosanna Marara were married women whose legal status was restricted by coverture. Those rules prohibited married women from prosecuting civil or criminal cases on their own, from entering into contracts, and owning most forms of property, at least not with some kind of workaround. But the court officials who adjudicated the case accepted both the women's claims to property ownership and their access to the legal system to defend those claims. For court officials, as well as the women involved, the question was which women possessed the sheet, not whether a woman could possess it. And here the image is on the outside of the case, you see all of the women, but they still have to attribute the sheet to William Allingham, even though William Allingham never appeared anywhere near this case. But that's because of coverture. They don't actually treat it in his property though. So what does the sheet, these women in this case, say about law and commerce in the United States? Those are the questions that are at the center of my new book, Only the Clothes in Her Back. And as I hope to explain, textiles, like Sarah Allingham's sheet, opened up a different view of the United States in the 19th century. And so just heads up here, by textiles, I mean all cloth, as well as clothing and related accessories, shoes, hats, socks, ribbons, bandana handkerchiefs. All of these were actually treated similarly in law. So the book then develops three related themes. First, there are all the material goods, the textiles, and the book is really as much about them as the people who used and claimed them. So in particular, the book traces the legal qualities that attach to textiles and then transfer to the people who possess them, allowing all those without strong claims to rights to make actual legal claims to this particular form of property, claims that were widely recognized in law in the New Republic. As such, textiles broaden the conventional historiographical focus, looking at the ways that property mediated people's relationship to law without altering those people's legal status. And so this is why I talk about all kinds of people, men and women, white and black, rich and poor, in the same book. It's because textiles and the legal qualities of textiles transfer to all of them, and all these people use these legal qualities in different ways. So that's the first thing. The second is the institutional implications of all of this. So textiles expose layers of the New Republic's federal system that carried over from its colonial past and that have gone largely unremarked in the historiography. And those spaces are like the ones you see in the slide. There's the Chowan County, North Carolina courthouse, which doesn't look very impressive. Some courts were held in mills, and the Hanover County courthouse from 1735, where a lot of county business was still done after the revolution. But all of these spaces played a significant role in governance. And in particular, people on the margins had wider latitude in them than is usually assumed. And then third, there are the economic implications. The legal qualities of textiles made it possible for people to convert these goods into a wide range of economic instruments that were otherwise inaccessible to the vast majority of the population, not only currency, but also capital and credit. And so here you see the Custom House at Wall Street, which is about both law and the regulation of commerce. And you see that space, but on the outside, you see all of these people who are in fact engaging in commerce themselves, just not inside the Customs House. So the fuss over Sarah Allingham's sheet was not actually unusual. Once you start looking for textiles, you realize that they were everywhere. People talked about them, they made them, they sold them, they squabbled over them all the time. So that one court case is just an example of the avalanche of evidence there is out there. Existing scholarship, though, has focused on the kinds of property, slaves, commodity, other forms of capital, which the men identified as the nation's leaders controlled. But all that was out of reach for the vast majority of Americans who were too poor to afford those forms of property or lacked the rights necessary to own them. For most Americans, if they owned anything of value at all, it was textiles. And their legal claims to these goods then reveal a very different trajectory of legal change than those posited narratives that focus on the rights of individuals. Rather than exclusion to inclusion, where people who don't have rights ultimately gain them, this narrative is one of twists and turns, where people are included and then lose it and then get a different form of inclusion. So the first part of the book, Old Clothes for a New Country, situates the New Republic within the textile trade, dynamics of which predated the revolution by centuries and which continued to shape its political economy after the revolution. As textiles suggest, much of the New Republic's legal order was not all that new. It carried over from the colonial era. And some of this was about textiles, which were moving through a global market long before Europeans even knew about the Americas. Governing officials in the early modern period did their best to control this lucrative trade, but trade restrictions in the colonial era acknowledged a well-established reality, which was a highly competitive global market characterized by mass production, which made imported cloth more cost-effective than many domestically produced varieties, even in countries with well-developed textile industries. The North American colonies provided a ready market for textiles produced elsewhere. The revolution was fueled in part by colonial merchants' desire for a greater share of that market. They wanted more. And after independence, the trade and production of textiles made fortunes for the new nation's leaders. We know that part of the story generally, although I don't think we fully appreciate how much the new nation's leaders depended on textiles for their wealth. The existing scholarship, however, has not yet teased out the full range of textiles' wide-ranging implications for the new republic's political economy. And at issue here is scale. When the scale of inquiry is fixed within the borders of the United States, what comes into focus is the economic and political power of the new republic's leaders. Those men seem to occupy center stage, if not completely in control of the ship of state, then certainly at its helm. And what we see is a rigid legal order that, if anything, became more hierarchical over time, marginalizing women, the enslaved, people of color, and working people. And you get a sense of scale here in that image, with men, white men, who are presiding over small enslaved people who are being sold at auction now. Focusing on textiles alters the scale, exposing economic and legal dynamics over which the new nation's leaders had far less control. Textiles traveled paths that had long traversed the jurisdictional or geographic boundaries of states, and they continued to do so after the revolution. While global in reach, the trade in textiles was also decidedly local. Once finished textiles landed, the market ceased being an abstraction, became a particular place where particular people had really particular tastes, which were not always logical or easy to determine. Most of the people who made up local markets, moreover, were the ones whose legal status was limited in the new republic. So here we have William Pratt to Mason and Lawrence textile commodities marketing firm. And they're enclosing samples of popular prints that he would like more for the Philadelphia market, which was different than the New York market. Every little town, city, had very particular tastes. So what we see from this perspective is a different kind of legal order, one with so many moving parts that they were difficult to pin down, let alone control. There were different jurisdictions. There was federal, state, and local. There were different bodies of law also that moved across those jurisdictions. And the legal qualities of textiles ran through this entire system. So take Roger Taney, Chief Justice of the US Supreme Court, for instance. He actually spent a great deal of time sorting through the legal status of textiles from his perch as a circuit court judge in the Southern District of New York. So Supreme Court justices rode circuit at that time in different federal courts. And my favorite case of his involved long underwear. And the question was whether it was knitwear or ready to wear, which mattered because custom duties for knitwear were much lower than for ready to wear. In this case, as in so many others, the legal qualities of long underwear, as testified to by the jobbers in Lower Manhattan, actually overrode federal law. And the case is pretty funny because, you know, they're looking at the textiles. Some guy's like, oh, look at the nice cotton band around the neck. That's got to be comfortable. And what did you say these were again? But they're looking at the materials themselves. And Taney's work in the Southern District of New York actually bore a striking resemblance to that of officials who decided Sarah Allingham's case in the New York City Mayor's Court. In fact, it took me a couple of days in the federal archives before I realized that this Roger Taney with the long underwear was the same Roger Taney who decided Dred Scott. In both New York courts, though, the Mayor's Court, the Customs House, officials took note of practices in very specific communities, be it the handling of linens by neighborhood women or the handling of knitwear by neighborhood jobbers. In this context, law was not confined to state houses or courthouses or elected officials and legal professionals. It also rested in the goods themselves, the way that ordinary people handled them, practices that were recognized by legal authorities. But the people for whom textiles mattered most were not Roger Taney, but those who remained subordinated within the new nation legally, politically, and economically. People of nominal legal standing were well aware that they could make claims to textiles, a point that Katie, an enslaved woman in New York City, articulated with stunning clarity. Charged with running away from her master and stealing a bundle of clothing, she admitted to absconding, but not to theft. As she explained, she was taking what was hers because she had worn those garments while working at her master's house. The clothing belonged to her, even though the body that wore them did not. Those legalities were so entrenched and so powerful that officials had to deal with them even when they conflicted with other laws and legal principles. Which brings us to the second part of the book, which is called Protective Garments in a Hostile World. And that turns to the ways that people use these legal qualities of textiles. Now, people have been using textiles as economic instruments long before the establishment of the New Republic. But the New Republic's legal order created new spaces for these practices to flourish precisely because it had all of these different kinds of competing, conflicting legal venues. So in the decades following the revolution, there was never enough currency. The proliferation of different kinds of notes of exchange meant that their value was always uncertain. And after Andrew Jackson nixed the Bank of the United States in the early 1830s, there was actually currency everywhere, but its value was even more unstable. So you could never tell when looking at a banknote what it was actually worth. More important, legal restrictions made the possession of all of those notes and even coins suspicious for many people and altogether illegal for enslaved people who were not allowed to own property in some areas of the law. So textiles actually satisfied a demand for secure, reliable medias of exchange that people could actually use. At this time, textiles had all the legal qualities that marked other forms of currency. There was actually considerable consensus as to their value. They were extremely liquid, and they also stored value pretty reliably, especially compared to these banknotes, which did not. And more importantly here, people could make legal claims to textiles because currency is not valuable at all if somebody can just say, you can't own it and take it away from you. So where the possession of other forms of property and banknotes like this would raise red flags, the possession of textiles was really much less remarkable. People then pegged textiles to the units account set by the state, pounds, and then dollars, like other forms of currency. So I find this fascinating to think about. When people were walking down the street and they looked at a piece of cloth or an item of clothing, they were assessing it and they saw pounds and shillings in dollars and cents. So the economic currency of textiles was rooted in their cultural currency. Clothes were so closely connected to the individual who wore them that they literally defined the essence of that person, or so people thought. And that connection made for a distinctive way of seeing and moving through the world. Garments were thought to capture the wearer's spirit in very personal terms. And all that meant that people noticed clothes and cloth. Declining prices and greater availability put more textiles in the hands of more people in the 18th century. That actually extends their cultural meanings more broadly through the population. And all that knowledge is on prominent display in theft cases. Parties to these cases could describe cloth and clothing in great detail, not only distinguishing cheap goods like this one from expensive ones, but also rattling off information about fiber content, colors, and patterns that most people today would never notice, let alone remember. All these details are really important because they established more value more accurately than figures on a banknote. So it is easy to miss the use of textiles as financial instruments because they also functioned as consumer goods. And such was the case with Elizabeth Cooley, whose work weaving and sewing might seem like, you know, typical domestic labor. But actually she, her sisters, and mother ran a textile manufacturing, and they kept the proceeds of what they made, and then they sunk those funds into more textiles. That they bought textiles was no accident. It was the only property that they could keep in their own names, which they all needed, given the economic failings of their menfolk. So they made cloth, they then bought other cloth, they put it into their trunks, and they kept it because they could keep it in their own name legally. Their menfolk could not claim it, and neither could the creditors of their husbands. So popular culture regularly decried such purchases as evidence of the frivolity of women, people of color, and the poor. But such purchases were hardly wasteful. They were wise investments in a form of property that people could legally control. Their savings also lay alongside textiles that they used, and they could be one and the same depending on context. People then traded textiles, they pawned them, they lent them, or they saved them to fund future ventures. The result was a vast secondary market, which provided not just access to goods, but also a means to circulate them outside the purview of retailers and governing officials, as well as masters, husbands, fathers, and their creditors. This part of the market was everywhere and included individuals who sold on the streets and from their homes. To say that this market was underground or informal misconstrues the institutional underpinnings. There were rules. Ownership was established through relationship to the goods as witnessed by other people through possession, use, and display. Although securing items in trunks could also establish ownership. Sarah Allingham lost her sheet because Rosanna Marara had exactly the kind of evidence that proved possession. There were witnesses who could describe the property and value it, connect it to the purported owner, provide the date of purchase, and verify the transaction. And trunks here are particularly important for people who don't own houses of their own. So this is a way of demarcating legally their possessions. People pawned cloth if they wanted it back. They loaned it if they did not. In pawning, people used clothing as collateral against which they borrowed. People charged with theft would often point out that they had pawned the goods, which meant that they could indeed get them back and could return them. So they hadn't really stolen them. But loans were different. With loans, the owner expected the return of the textile's value plus interest in some form, not the goods themselves, which decline in value with use and over time. You know, when you loan somebody a handkerchief and they blow their nose, it's like, well, you know, you keep it, that's okay. And all these rules matter. Sarah Allingham was not just mad about her lost property, although she was mad about that. She was also mad that the rules structuring property exchange had been violated. In fact, the case was not really theft in the way we ordinarily think of theft. It was the kind of credit dispute common to this part of the textile market. Sarah Allingham had actually loaned the sheet to her neighbor, Sally Riley, not because Sally Riley was in desperate need of bed linens, but because both women were leveraging the sheet's value. Riley then sold it to Rosanna Marara, which was accepted practice and did not negate her obligation to repay the value of the sheet. It was only after Allingham believed that Riley had reneged on the loan that she took matters into her own hands and seized the sheet, hoping to recoup at least some of her loss. And then she went to court. Expectations of enforcement ran so deep that people like Sarah Allingham insisted on legal redress. That was possible because of the many layers of the legal order. People without strong claims to rights were locked out of the area of law, civil law, which handled property disputes. So officials shifted the cases to public law, a different area of law, where those cases could be tried as criminal offenses, as theft. Public law looked after the interests of the social order, not the rights of individuals. The point in this area of law was to put things aright, to put them back where they belong, and that included sheets. Within this legal rubric, court officials could act on complaints as threats to the public order, as something that had gone awry, that was out of place. So they could even act on property claims made by those without property rights. Prosecution then repaired the rift, restored the property to the place where it belonged without recognizing the rights of the particular people involved. So where were merchants and manufacturers in all of this? In a word, they were very frustrated. The market in textiles and its legalities confounded them, but they were in a bind because they had depended on the business of people with tenuous claims to property and without property rights. They sold to married women all the time. They also sold to enslaved people. They sold to poor people. They sold to people of color. If you knocked all of those people out, then they had very few customers left. The thing was here that merchants and manufacturers, though, wanted to simply sell textiles to people as consumers. Consumers bought new textiles and paid for them at the point of purchase. Then consumers took their textiles home where they wore them out so they could come back and buy more. They were not supposed to strike out on their own and turn the items into economic and legal power, currency, collateral, savings, and the means of mobilizing the courts as active members of the public order. That was not the plan, but that's what was happening. That said, merchants and manufacturers found it impossible to crack down on this part of the market. Doing so would damage their own economic interests. And beyond that, they had less control over all the legal qualities of textiles, which were rooted in practice. The legal order in this period, in other words, was not entirely under their control. So the third part of the book, Rags, pans back out to deal with the broader implications of these legal claims and changes over time. So legal qualities of textiles only went so far. They could not cancel out the fact that the value of textiles continued to decline. Just as important, the framing of public law criminalized the varied property disputes of people without claims to rights, property, or both. So this legal frame made their possession of property seem different, illegitimate, criminal. What were loans for white men became theft. What were other kinds of property transactions for white men also became theft. It all became theft. And the implications then would become inescapable later in the 19th century as the legal order continued to evolve. The claims of those without strong property rights existed in parts of the legal system that emphasized relationships, practices that not only assumed a meaningful connection between a person and the material world, but that also required the participation of other people, if only as witnesses. And those on the margins had the best chance of making claims, at those kinds of claims, in the realm of public law at the local level, where they could make all those relationships visible. They could bring in their friends, they could bring in all the material goods. But then in the decades leading up to the Civil War, legal authority started shifting towards those areas of law that focused on the rights of unencumbered individuals. Rights stripped out relationships of all kinds to focus in on individuals. And rights belonged only to certain people, to free people who were unrestricted by slavery, coverture, or the racial, gender, and class-based restrictions that were closely allied with slavery and coverture. Which is to say, of course, that rights belong primarily to white men. Now, rights, don't get me wrong, are extremely useful in the US context, where claims to textiles stayed in those particular areas, in those very localized spaces where all those relationships were known. Rights-based claims to property traveled freely through the federal system across the whole mess of jurisdictional lines in the New Republic. Rights, in other words, were a much needed legal constant across all of the jurisdictional lines of federalism. It was difficult to navigate a legal order where everything varied from state to state and also depended on local practice. It's like, okay, who owns what, where, when? I don't know. I have to go talk to people in every single place. Better to have an abstract, universal standard. Merchants hated all of this, and they were not the only ones. That mess of laws also determined a person's legal status and how they could move through the world. It was particularly acute for enslaved people. They're free in one place, they cross the line, the presumption is they're enslaved, their whole world changes. No wonder then that abolition, women's rights, and the rights of free Blacks became key political issues in the decades leading up to the Civil War. The problem though was that the extension of rights also came at the expense of textiles. And rights did not eliminate other aspects of the legal order that kept all women, African Americans, and even poor white men from inhabiting the role of a rights-bearing individual. Textiles had given them legal cover. Without them, they were vulnerable. And here you get a sense of the power of rights, also the visual power of textiles and its implication with rights. And this is very common visual representation in this period. So this is enslaved people are being recruited in Charleston, South Carolina. And as enslaved people, they're wearing rags. Rags is used to symbolize people who are on the margin somehow. Something is wrong. It could be because they are being victimized. It could be because they have a moral disorder of their own. In this case, it's because they're being victimized. In the middle, you have an African-American soldier who has his hand on the enslaved man, and he's going to bring him over to the other side where all of the soldiers are neatly clad in Union uniforms. And this becomes then the recognition too of their movement over into this new rights-based world. But still, unless their rights are being enforced, textiles had given them legal cover. And textiles had always mattered because the options available to all Americans without rights or resources were so few. And textiles then, as they lose in power, they also reveal a history where the extension of rights cannot be told as an easy narrative of inclusion and progress. What you're seeing in this image here is not necessarily what is going to be happening where people trade their rags for rights. In fact, it's a much more complicated world where textiles provide a legal cover and rights are going to be not completely enforced. So they reveal this world where the extension of rights cannot be told as this easy narrative of inclusion and progress as men and women on the margins acquire rights and we solve everything. Instead, textiles tell a different history of law and the economy, one where the experiences of women, rather than those of theoretical rights-bearing individuals who are usually presumed to be men, are representative. Women were actually like the vast majority of Americans, with compromised rights, thought to be on the outside of the economy and the government. But they were always inside, and inside largely because of their own efforts of using creatively the materials at hand. These people could imagine a world where they could claim their labor, possess property, define their own destinies, even live their lives in color, because those things were possible to imagine. This political culture also cut across and through these different groups of people because of its roots deep in the past, in a legal world that textiles reveal. Thanks.
Thank you. That was excellent. Can you tell us a little bit about what made you or what inspired you to write this book?
Yes. In fact, I've always, first of all, there is the personal side of this, which is I've always been fascinated by cloth and clothing. My mother used to sew all my own clothes. I would sit across from her at the kitchen table where she had her sewing machine, and I would sew as a small child, which meant that she would give me some of the, you know, scraps that she had from cutting things out, and she'd hand them over to me, and I would very studiously cut armholes for, you know, a dress for my stuffed rabbit. So I sort of progressed from that. It was hard when you're 3 years old to get those armholes, like, even. I was like, oh gosh, this is tough. So I progressed from there, and now I still do lots of sewing and needlework. And I've just always found it incredibly fascinating that you can turn a flat piece of fabric into something that's three-dimensional and beautiful. Mm-hmm. That the labor involved in that strikes me as really meaningful in a very personal way. So I kind of have that in the background. And then I was starting in another book, I was running across cases where, like Sarah Allingham's sheet, on the outside of the court case, it says, and this is one case in particular, and the guy, I believe his name was John Marshall, not the Supreme Court Justice, but a farmer in North Carolina, and it said that his dress had been stolen, and this is like the 1820s. I'm like, so this could be really interesting that John Marshall had a dress in right. North Carolina in the 1820s. Or there's something else going on here. And, you know, I was sitting there in the archives thinking, so what does John Marshall look like when he wears his dress while he's plowing in the field?
Sure.
I'm thinking something else is going on. And in fact, sure enough, it's his wife's dress, and they treat it as her dress. And the whole case, you know, unfolds as her dress. And I ran across a couple other of these cases, and I didn't find so many of them in rural areas. And I think that's partly because everybody knows each other's clothes to the point where it's really, really hard to steal them. Mm-hmm. But I determined that I'm going to look for more of these. And so I did. And then all of a sudden there was, like I said, this avalanche of material.
Wow.
And then it also struck me as fascinating that the legal claims to this are so important, right? That we've often dismissed. Many people dismiss. I'm hoping the people who are watching this did not dismiss it, but we undervalue the labor that goes into the production of cloth and clothing, and we kind of assume it's just what women did. And in fact, the idea here that women in particular could claim the value, and that's why they're located in these textile trades, and it's also why free Black people are often located in the textile trades as well, as are enslaved people, because this is the thing that they can claim. And it's like, oh my gosh, there's a world that I hadn't seen before.
Yeah, really interesting. And I was thinking too, when you think about the value of textiles, I can remember once, I think I might've been at Historic Deerfield when someone, we were looking at, like, you know, a bedspread and like curtains all around the bed and talking about how expensive that was. And how when we're looking at textiles, we're sort of looking at the fuel of the 18th and 19th century, because this was what powered, you know, ships all over the world. And so as precious and expensive as we think of fuel, you know, today, that's what textiles were, you know, centuries ago. So when you talk about people walking down the street and seeing each other in clothes and thinking of those clothes, you know, with like a monetary value, it put me in mind of that too, that these aren't just, it's not just about fashion or protection or comfort, that there's, no pun intended, there's a lot of different layers, right, to textiles and to clothing.
Yes. No, and I, you know, the bed linens, I mean, all of what you, I mean, the bed linens, all of that is because the curtains, the bedspread, the sheets, the pillowcases, all of that is usually worth more than the actual bed itself. The bed, and some of the, that's often the most expensive group of items in an inventory. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so you can see if women can claim that, it's like, oh gosh, they've just like grabbed out the most expensive things in that house.
Yeah.
So
big deal.
Big deal. Also, it also means that it is not able to be seized by creditors who get first claim to everything in an estate. Oh,
okay. Interesting.
Yeah.
I know someone in the audience is asking about Elizabeth Cooley, whose photo was in your presentation. Mm-hmm. She and her family they're asking, are they from the UK or the United States?
The United States. They live in Western Virginia, in that piece of, it's not West Virginia, but that piece of Virginia that's right there, like North Carolina and Tennessee. So yeah, they live there. And their father is a watchmaker, and it's a kind of poor area at this point because farming, it's very hilly, and then they can't get in their crops to market. There are only so many watches there. And actually the Cooley women all basically rely on their textiles that they have amassed while working for their mother, essentially, when they get married, because men in this period, the economy's up and down, and even well-meaning men can't always support their family, and women and their textile skills are really crucial in tiding people through.
Interesting. So that makes me wonder too, it sounds like your book focuses on the United States, but do you know if, you know, legal systems like this, is this how it operates in other parts of the world when it comes to textiles in the 1800s?
You know, some of the literature that I've read, especially on the UK, suggests that in fact it does, but people haven't really pieced together the legal aspect of this. You know, legal history is often seen as something separate and different.
Yeah.
And it is seen as something that's like, oh, that involves Roger Taney and these big Supreme Court cases.
Right.
And it's really apart from what ordinary people do. And so much of the work that I do is actually about reconstructing this legal world that people lived in and moved through in their daily life in the 19th century. And so, you know, I'm an odd legal historian that I joined that sort of sense with material culture and cultural history and social history with the law, and also look at venues, legal venues that other people just don't. And so other people have, who are doing kind of the material culture end of this, John Stiles would be a good example of this. They have noted the court cases, but they haven't kind of pieced together the whole legal apparatus. But I think it's there in other places as well. Mm-hmm. And what is interesting here is that you have those legal principles that are kind of moving across country boundary lines. I mean, this idea that people can make connections to their own clothing, that they own their own clothes. I mean, that's kind of like, it goes with the textiles themselves. It's pretty universal. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting how we've kind of ignored those elements of the legal system in favor of looking at the ones that we kind of associate with like the federal government or state governments,
right,
and not seen these other elements where people are really participating and creating law, which I also find fascinating.
It's something else I was thinking of while you were talking, and a lot of the things that came up in your talk is how you're actually the second legal scholar that we've had speak for this series on our exhibit about clothing. Richard Thompson Ford joined us several weeks ago and talked about his book, Dress Codes. His book looks a bit more at like law and fashion as opposed to like, you know, like clothing as legal forms of currency or asserting rights. But there's a lot of interesting crossover in terms of like a claiming your individuality, if you will, and it when it comes to you know, he looked at fashion choices in terms of saying this is who I am as an individual, and here we're looking at property ownership side, you know, that side of clothing in terms of your individuality and your rights.
Right. You know, it's fascinating too, because it's because people can make this personal connection with their clothing that they can also alienate it. So it's this contradiction that's wound up and creates the possibility to actually turn them into something else. Mm-hmm. So it's because these things are so personally closely associated with a particular person. It's like, that's my jacket.
Yes.
And there are these cases that I run across all over up and down the East Coast where somebody will be walking down the street and they'll say, that person's wearing my friend's jacket, and off they go and they tackle the person and then they haul them to the court, and they're like the mayor's court, constables, you know,
whatnot. Right.
And I'm like, I wouldn't do that today.
Right. I mean,
First of all,
the shirt that I got at Old Navy, like thousands of other people.
No, exactly. Wearing.
Yeah.
They're wearing a sweatshirt, but Old Navy on it. It's like, how would you recognize that?
Right.
And then there's the whole part about, wait a minute, you endangered your life by running somebody down in the street, and then you take time out of your day to haul them to make a complaint in the court. It's like, wow, that's a different way of seeing, right? And but when you, some of the testimony is fascinating because it is like the people are saying, no, it was my friend's coat. I had to get it back. And it was more that it wasn't just a piece of property. It was a piece of their friend that he needed to earn. And there's an element of that too. It's like, wow, we just don't think of that anymore.
No.
Although there are some of those things where like you lose your favorite sweater and you really feel bereft.
Right. Yeah. You can get very attached, right? We're getting some other questions from the audience. Someone is saying that, this discussion makes them wonder when women pass down something like a wedding dress or a baptismal gown or similar, like ritual clothing, are they also passing along an economic gift as well as something that's sentimental?
Yes, they are. And that's what is amazing about Elizabeth Cooley and what's in her trunk, right? And, that what is happening there is they're passing along, women are passing along the capital that they can pass along, right? So this is, to sort of back up a second, in the 1790s, 1810s, 20s, there are all of this, all of these kinds of articles and stories in the popular press about these women who are all just, they're so taken up with European fashion and they're frivolous. They're not good, hardworking Yankee women. Mm-hmm. Or in the South, they're not good, hardworking post-revolutionary women. And they're certainly not, the kinds of, wives that this country now needs in our new republic. But what's happening is usually that, mothers are passing a trousseau, but the trousseau is a form of capital. So you're transferring the value that the mother can produce onto the daughter, and then the daughter will pass those things on as well. And, people make dresses last a very long time. Things do wear out, obviously, but you make them last as long as you can. And for, a ceremonial outfit, you can make them last much longer because you don't wear them, right? So the fabric itself is extremely valuable, and passing them along has that element to it. Over time, though, and you can see this happening, it becomes more about sentiment than it does about the economics.
Right.
And that's about the declining value of these goods, but it's also about their declining legal value too.
Right. I'm reminded too of, women using sort of like the guise of buying clothing is a political act too. So like during the time of suffrage, like in the early 1900s, when women didn't have access to money of their own, but could draw upon like their husband's credit at a store, might go and say, I want you to put this down as I bought this bonnet. But what I need is the money to donate, to the political cause instead, which is kind of interesting if you think about, criticism of, spending on frivolous things. But in that example, it's a way to get away with, kind of claiming access to some property into some political activity.
Right. And then disguising it as a bonnet means that it's hers. So she's also turned it into her property. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which, all of that, now that I see it in those terms, I was like, oh my gosh, there's all of this transfer of property and people are constantly trying to do this. And that this even works for enslaved people to a certain extent is pretty stunning. You know, somebody asked me one time, why would masters go along with this? And it's like, you get back to the point that you were making about the way that clothing speaks about your inner self, right? So enslavers at this period are very, you know, concerned about what their community thinks about them. And so to have enslaved people who they claim as their property walk around and look tired,
it
says something about them personally. And so they were often okay with this idea, even though they're not going to supply the clothes themselves.
Right.
They're okay with granting enslaved people a certain amount of leeway to, you know, purchase and keep that kind of property. Doesn't always work, but it's more likely to work.
Yeah. Someone else is asking, did young children's clothing have the same attributes in the context of property value?
Yeah, yeah, they do. Although it's harder with young children, right? Because like little young children are not usually, they don't like get their little trunk full of stuff and say, Mom, this is mine. You know, children are actually expected at a certain point to be economically viable in a family. And so they too start sort of amassing, you know, try to amass some value for themselves. One of the more interesting examples of this is apprentices and freedom suits.
Yes.
So when apprentices, you know, end the period of their indenture, and these are young people, they're not children, but they're young people, they would usually get a freedom suit and literally a suit of clothes. And everybody always assumed it's like, oh, it's just what they need to like be decent and wear, right? No, it's actually a payment, right? So it's a payment to them of clothing. And in one of the magistrate's records that I was looking at in Philadelphia, at one point, sort of in the 1830s, he moves from freedom suits. He still calls them freedom suits, but he gives them a cash payment.
Wow.
It's the same thing, right? And so to give somebody a nice suit of clothes is also to dress them for a new situation, which has value in and of itself. I mean, to look good means you have better prospects. And not for superficial reasons, but because people really think at that time that it expresses who you are. But then it's also valuable. They can pawn that. They can they can use them.
Someone else is commenting, you'll appreciate this, I think, as someone who sews. Anyone who sews will understand what I say when I say I talk about my fabric hoard or stash, and that she appreciates now being able to consider it like a savings account.
Yeah, no, exactly, right? And all of this language is so interesting, how textiles often overlap with economics. So like consider money laundering. This is exactly what do with stolen clothing. And there's this huge market in secondhand market in clothes, right? But people will launder the goods. And by that, they mean to put them into the secondhand market, move them further away. But they also literally mean laundering the goods, which to launder like dirty clothes makes them more valuable.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much. This is a really fascinating talk, fascinating subject. The book is called Only the Clothes on Her Back. I shared the link in our chat. You can purchase the book at our museum store. So you can visit us in person at 489 Congress Street in Portland, or visit mainhistorystore.com and you can find the book there. Thank you again so much, Dr. Edwards. It was really a pleasure to have you with us tonight.
Thank you, Kathleen. This is really fun.
Thanks. Take care, everybody.